public hearing today on two bills, House Bill 5026, which is the budget bill for the Department of Environmental Quality, and House Bill 5027, which is a fee bill for the Department of Environmental Quality. Open a public hearing on House Bill 5026 and House Bill 5027. Mr. Siebert, would you please...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I've passed out at your place a number of handouts, including responses from questions from Phase 1 hearings. There's also a letter from the director on the prioritization. You have a copy of the presentation that the agency will be going through. You have a copy of the presentation that Lisa Pearson from Department of Administrative Services Budget Management will go through on the governor's recommended budget. And some more information that the Air Quality Division will get to about the vehicle inspection program. And then the department provided you a short summary of the packages that are included in their budget. And I believe we're going to start out with the director talking about the responses and their response to the prioritization of the agency's programs.
Ms. Halleck, and whoever you'd like to bring with you are more than welcome to join you. And on behalf of Representative Krieger, let me just state for him that could you let us know exactly what piece of paper you're looking at and where in the books we're supposed to be?
Madam Chair, thank you. For the record, Stephanie Halleck, Director of DEQ, and I'd be happy to do that. And at the table with me is Lisa Pearson, our analyst from the Department of Administrative Services. Are you going to start? Okay. We're going to, as Paul Siebert said, first of all, I want to be able to respond to any Phase 1 questions that you have. That would be the letter that is dated February 25th, addressed to Representative Morgan, that responds to some questions you had in Phase 1. And then secondly, the letter that Mr. Siebert referred to, addressed to Representative Morgan, dated April 19th, which addresses some concerns that we have about the subcommittee's prioritization. And I just make a couple of comments about that, unless you have any questions for me about the response to Phase 1.
Let me just glance at these. I think that the responses to questions from Phase 1 would probably best be just addressed by, if the individuals that ask the questions have questions about the answer, we'll just direct them to come back to you. But I would like to spend some time discussing your response to our prioritization.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I may, in the letter, I call out two specific concerns, and just by way of a refresher on the priority list about what happened when we spoke to you before, we have 18 programs listed on the priority list. The subcommittee made no changes to the ranking of the first nine of those, and the categories that were included there were protection of public health and safety, our base water programs, our base air permitting programs, and our base hazardous waste program. The subcommittee did make some changes in the ranking of the second half of our list, programs 10 through 18. We don't have problems with most of the changes, but we do have concerns about the two programs that were ranked lowest, as I've described in the letter. What happened in that discussion is that the subcommittee placed our air quality area and toxics program and our water quality non-point source programs last on the list at 17 and 18. We had prioritized those programs at number 11 and number 13 because they address most of the air and water pollution in Oregon, and I'm sure you remember hearing me talk about that quite a bit, about how we're getting most of our pollution now not so much from the regulated point sources in air or water, but really in the everyday activities of all of us. The other concern I have on the air side in particular is when we manage air pollution in an airshed, we come up with maintenance plans that you've heard me talk about before that take into consideration all of the contributions to pollution, and they come up with we come up with the communities and strategies for dealing with those. For example, in the metropolitan Portland area, the vehicle inspection program is a big part of the strategy for reducing overall air pollution. What that means is, if in this delicate balance among the various contributors, if one part of the contribution is not in effect, it can put more burden on another part. So in this case, if we reduce our funding and our ability to reduce pollution from area mobile sources, from wood stoves, from all the smaller sources, we could potentially be putting more regulatory burden on our industries and on economic development if we go out of attainment with air quality standards because of that. So I wanted to be sure and point out that relationship.
So where in the state would cutting the air quality program have the greatest impact? Would it be the places that are now under air quality restrictions?
Madam Chair, the way I'd answer that is right now we are in attainment with all air quality standards statewide. We are in attainment because communities that were not in attainment previously made some extraordinary efforts working with our department to come into attainment. Those geographic areas include Northeast Oregon, for particulate matter, include Southern Oregon, Klamath Falls, Medford, Grants Pass, both for particulate matter and for carbon monoxide, the metropolitan Portland area. In addition to those are areas that have most recently had problems. As you look back historically, there have been other areas as well. Eugene Springfield, I think I mentioned to you in phase one that we continually monitor vehicle pollution in the Bend area as that area grows. Ontario area, we've had concerns about dust for particular matters. So we basically look statewide for different different pollutants. Some are particulate, some are ozone, some are carbon monoxide. So in this case, I think we have a maintenance plan coming up for Salem that is going to be delayed because of the cuts already made in the governor's recommended budget, and I'll get to that when I talk about air quality. So there are different parts of the state that we look at carefully depending on the pollutant. But the ones that I've just mentioned to you, Southern Oregon, Northeast Oregon, metropolitan Portland area, are the ones right now that we continue to monitor very, very closely to make sure they don't go back out of attainment.
So talk to us about what the impact would be on services or on the programs to budget cuts. What would go after the cuts that you've already implemented?
In this program, in the air quality program?
What I'm trying to get a feel for is if the committee makes the decision to leave this down at the bottom of the list, being says these two are general funded, they're probably pretty vulnerable where they're at right now, I'm just trying to get a feel for what a 10% reduction beyond what you've already taken or a 20% reduction beyond what you've already taken would look like.
Madam Chair, let me make one point of clarification, and while I'm doing that, I would like to ask Andy Ginsberg, who's the Air Quality Administrator, to join me at the table. But the point of clarification I want to make is between the two items at the bottom of the list. The water quality non-point source prioritization, that's actually not a general fund. It's at the bottom, but it is a federally funded program. And what is really at risk is $7.1 million of federal money that if Oregon decided we didn't want it, then that money would basically be returned to the feds and they would allocate it out to other states.
What's the $150,000 that's in the general fund column?
There is a small piece of other fund that is basically the indirect rate on indirect services. And one second, Holly, what's the $150,000 on the general fund?
It's the overall infrastructure support.
Okay, it's Madam Chair, from Holly Schroeder, the Water Division Administrator. It's it's the non-point source program's contribution to administrative overhead in the water program, as separate from the administrative overhead of the agency as a whole. Now, if I may, I'd like to ask Andy Ginsberg from the AIR program to specifically tell you what further cuts to the Area Mobile, $3 million of general fund that's potentially at risk by having it ranked second to the bottom. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Andy Ginsberg, for the record, the Air Quality Division Administrator. In the subprogram for the area and toxics, the first thing is that we have a good amount of the funding for our laboratory for ambient air quality monitoring is included in that subprogram. Approximately half of the funding for our laboratory is in that subprogram. If we were to lose that funding, we would virtually have to eliminate monitoring outside of the Portland metropolitan area. It would be a substantial reduction in our ability to measure performance, our ability to track our performance measure, our benchmark throughout the rest of the state. And the reason for that is that we get a lot of efficiency by having we monitor for multiple different kinds of pollutants, as Director Halleck was saying, for particulate, for ozone, for carbon monoxide, for toxics, for visibility, and meteorology as well. And if we just eliminate one of those types of monitoring, it doesn't save us that much money because we still have to send staff out to service the monitoring equipment. So the only way to absorb a reduction of that magnitude in the laboratory would be actually to eliminate monitoring in various parts of the state. So that would be the first impact. The second is for the open burning program. Open burning is one of our largest sources of particulate matter in the state. It's a significant contributor to visibility impairment. It's a major source of toxic air pollutants, but primarily it's a source of particulate matter. And we have staff that respond to open burning complaints. We have staff that work with local fire districts to try and prevent illegal backyard burning of plastic and tires and other kinds of prohibited materials. And that program has already been cut in previous biennia from budget reductions. It's fully funded by general fund, and all of the funding is in the subprogram that was ranked at the bottom of the list. So we would essentially have to eliminate our open burning program. We wouldn't be able to respond to complaints, and more significantly, we wouldn't be able to assist the local fire districts when they're dealing with open burning issues. In addition, our visibility protection program is included in that sub-program. And so visibility is there's two aspects to visibility protection.
Yes. Interject. The assistance that you give to the local fire districts, can you give me a little bit more information about what that is?
Sure, Madam Chair. The local fire districts make the burn and no burn calls for a specific area based on fire conditions. We work with them on deciding when meteorological conditions are correct for making burn calls. We follow up when they have illegal burns with complaints, with enforcement. We provide technical assistance to them as well. For the visibility protection program, this is aimed both at protecting visibility in our wilderness areas and our Crater Lake National Park, but also preventing visibility that transports long distances, which we call regional haze, that contributes to visibility impairment in places as far away as the Grand Canyon. And it's a major national effort right now to try and reduce haze in the West, and all of our funding for working on regional haze and visibility protection, including working with the Department of Forestry on smoke management and Department of Agriculture on field burning, all of that is included in this sub-program.
And so what happens if that goes away?
If that were to go away, first we wouldn't be able to oversee the work of the Department of Forestry on smoke management programs. As an example, we've recently had some issues in the city of Florence where we had smoke impairment from forestry burning near the city of Florence, and we received a number of calls from citizens there that have been impacted, health had been impacted because of smoke in their area. And so we wouldn't be able to respond, assist citizens. We wouldn't be able to work with the Department of Forestry on improving their smoke management program. And that program is included in our federally approved plans that Director Halleck was talking about as part of our protecting or meeting the federal standard for particulate matter. So if we weren't able to meet those commitments, it would be another aspect of falling short of the commitments we put in the plan for meeting the standards on which EPA allowed us to redesignate places like Medford and Grants Pass and Klamath Falls to attain for the particulate standard. So the long-term consequence of not meeting those commitments would be we could lose our designation as attainment if we actually violate air quality standards as a result of it, then we could end up with more regulations on industry.
So what I'm trying to get a feel for then is would a small reduction in this program put the air quality piece in jeopardy, just kind of get a feel for the scope of the reductions and the impact that they'd have.
Madam Chair, if I could just interject one thing. I did want to point out that in our original 10% list that we provided to you, there was a $200,000 general fund cut to this program on our own list.
Representative Schaffner?
Thank you. If we don't meet our particulate standards with the federal government that came in to regulate us, you said we could potentially lose some investment for industry. At the levels we fund all this stuff, relative to other states that have had to cut back due to lack of revenue, has anybody around the country lost out? Are there any examples of where people have not met these standards, the federal government regulated more, and they lost out on industry or growth of industry or job-creating opportunities? Or anywhere, is there an example of that happening in the country? And has it ever happened to us?
Actually, Andy's going to answer Representative Schaffler, but it's not only loss of industry, it's also potentially loss of federal highway dollars, and Andy can respond specifically.
Just so I can make it clear, has it ever happened before, and was it directly related to lack of funding a program like this? That's really what I want to get at.
Representative Schaffler, Madam Chair, I don't know if I can answer the question directly whether it has actually been related to the loss of funding in a program, but it has happened where an area violates the air quality standards. The way the Clean Air Act is designed, there's an assumption that industry is the biggest part of the air quality problem, and that's because it is back east and in other parts of the country. So automatically, when areas violate air quality standards, more restrictive regulations fall on industry. They're required to put on the most expensive emission control technology, regardless of cost. They're required to reduce existing emissions around the area where they're putting their new facility, equal to or greater than the amount of emissions they're going to add. And so the net effect of that requirement is that it's large delays in the ability to permit facilities. And that's where typically the loss occurs, that an industry will decide, well, I'm going to, instead of going to Medford where it's going to take me a year and a half to get a permit, I'm going to go somewhere else where it's going to be quicker and simpler. So it's a little difficult to quantify that type of thing. It's hard to tell if that was the reason they moved or, you know, chose not to construct here or not.
One more question. 2 years from now, if you get lucky and get this money and we maintain these standards, are you going to be able to come back and show me where somebody got a permit to build some manufacturing industry in the state because we did? Just because we did maintain these standards? And I'm asking for a lot. I know I am. But if you could, it would really help.
I would say, Representative Schaffler, I would say probably. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's two things. First of all, we'd be happy to see if we can get you more specific information about where there have been sanctions or where there's been some problem nationwide. We can get that. And secondly, I think an important point, and hopefully you will hear this in public testimony tomorrow as well, we've had a lot of support from industry in this state for this part of the AIR program, the development of a program within DEQ and within the state to address other types of pollution, for the very reason that they understand that if we don't, that it comes down on their heads.
And if I could just add to that, we do have our program over the last 10 or 15 years has been all about getting into attainment everywhere in the state, and we've been extremely successful in that. You've seen our performance measure, and the net effect of that is that we've made it a more industry-friendly state. That is, we don't have any non-attainment areas where those more expensive and time-consuming permitting requirements occur. That took us 10 to 15 years to get there. Back in the 1980s, in the late 70s and throughout most of the 80s, we were violating the standards regularly in multiple cities throughout Oregon. And so this long-term investment, and a lot of it was in area sources, our wood stove control program, our open burning program, our smoke management program, and on the ozone, for particulate, and on the ozone side, looking at things like aerosol sprays and motor vehicle emissions, and you know, all the paints, all the different things that add up to a lot of pollution.
We need to move on. Andy is passionate about the air program.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Andy. If there are no further questions about the priority list, that was all I intended to say about that, and then I was just going to move on to tell you what we did with regard to performance
Senator
measures.
Senator Bates, you kind of came in two-thirds of the way through this. Do you have any questions you
want
to ask?
Madam Chair, I suppose I do. First off, we have caucus from 12 to 1:15 every day. Like, geez, you know, I just race out there and come out. I'm always arriving late. It's like the first part of the meeting, you get the hot stuff. Thanks.
Well, that's
you do it good on purpose,
planning.
Right? Yeah. The only comment I have is this. Representative Morgan, you're a tough act to follow. This is extremely important in my particular area, in the Medford area. We've just gone through a very difficult time for our community as far as air quality is concerned, and frankly, we're surprised by where we ended up on some regulation questions. As far as cars concerned and as far as industry was concerned, that was a major discussion we had. It wasn't, from my memory, about wood burning people's backyards. We have red days and green days, and we try to enforce those. We've done a very good job of reducing the airshed difficulty in the Medford area. The Rogue Valley is a very unusual area. I've been told it's the second or third worst place on the West Coast for air quality because of the geography of the area. Everything gets trapped in that valley, and there's very little crosswind because of the orientation of the valley to get it out. I am a little concerned that we've prioritized this lower than we should have. I have some concerns there. On the other hand, looking at the state as a whole, it probably fits reasonably well. I don't think we should look at the final budget on these programs the basis of purely on priorities. We've talked about this before, that if we have to make cuts, they're not going to be strictly based on one priority being completely lost versus the others. So I'm making a point here on the record that from Medford point of view, the district I live in and that I represent, air quality is a bigger issue than water quality, substantially bigger issue than water quality. And that needs to be recognized, and that's where my voice will be on this issue if it comes down to making cuts. We'll have a discussion at that point about it. Okay? And thank you for leaving the time.
And I think that the information that the department's brought forward on the issues that are raised by ranking these things at the bottom is something that we should consider when we go into Stage 3 and finalize the priority listing. And hopefully we'll find a place here where we can balance all of the needs.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Let's move ahead.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just briefly on the performance measures to finish out our Phase 1 wrap-up, the subcommittee requested modifications to two measures. Senator Bates requested a modification to performance measure number 4, water quality permit timeliness. DEQ has modified it to add the target, which is 270 days. The measure now reads percentage of wastewater discharge permits issued within the 270-day target period. The
Where are the performance measures?
Yeah,
in a book someplace.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there's the old performance measures are in your presentation notebooks.
Oh, and the new ones are in that little thing they sent out. Didn't we get something?
Madam Chair, there was a letter provided on February 14th that wasn't in this packet this time that had the performance
measures. I know where
it is
in my office.
Attached to it.
The
performance measures are in that binder that Paul has. I guess Lori is going to hand out another set of copies of this. And I apologize, Madam Chair. We have so much material for 2 days that I was hoping not to inundate you.
Stuff we need more.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now that you all have it in front of you, performance measure number 4 was the one where Senator Bates requested modification, and we have, in fact, changed it to read the percentage of wastewater discharge permits issued within the 270-day target period. He had requested that we add the target period. The other measure that around which there was some discussion was performance measure 15, which is the economic revitalization team performance measure. And we are in discussions. I've been talking to Mr. Siebert about my efforts to talk with the other agencies and the governor's economic revitalization team members to help come up with a measure that applies to all the agencies. My understanding is that you are interested in measuring how the ERT affects how quickly projects are completed or how efficiently the team has addressed problems. If there are other things you'd like addressed, please let me know. We have an ERT meeting right after this session, and I'm going to discuss it with them at that ERT meeting. And I've given some ideas. I shared with Mr. Siebert some thoughts I had for how we might turn this into something measurable, and I'm going to discuss that with the other directors today.
I think that in discussions with the co-chairs, that the co-chairs are very interested in trying to set up some kind of a performance measure where we would be able to gauge attainment according to the investment that is made in the program. So timeliness is, I think, a big piece here. What kinds of projects are committed to within what kinds of time frames, and then put performance measures within the agencies that have the leads for those particular kinds of projects that measure the performance against the schedule that, or some kind of schedule that it can be measured against.
Madam Chair, the other idea I had that I shared with Mr. Siebert is, and I don't know if it's workable or not, but as you know, the governor's office has regional coordinators for the ERT. And oftentimes the issue, the problem or the new project or whatever comes to the table of that person first. And then they convene the ERT. And so one of the thoughts I had was if you sort of vest the tracking in the governor's office ERT person and the clock starting when the convening happens or when it is assigned, and or there could be another piece of the measure that is how quickly they personally resolve the problem, because sometimes they do. You know, they get an issue brought to them, they call somebody up, and it gets fixed. So that is where, because I was trying to think, if you have all these diverse agencies, you know, it could get really complicated and smushy, but if you can somehow make it very clear and link it to the projects that the ERT coordinators are invested in leading. Anyway, that's the idea I'm going to float today.
And I think that that's an aspect of it, but I think that there's also an aspect of being able to track agencies that are primarily responsible for aspects to see if there are certain agencies that are consistently not being able to perform against timelines, or certain agencies that are consistently being able to perform, and then using that to try to get deeper into what the reasons are for success and what the reasons are for not attaining, and see if there can't be some kind of mitigation.
Okay. Thank you. That helps. And we'll talk about it this afternoon, and we'll be talking with you, I'm sure, again about it. At this point, I'm going to, if you're ready to move on, Lisa Pearson from Department of Administrative Services would talk about our budget.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. My name is Lisa Pearson with the Department of Administrative Services, and I'm working from this document here. You should have in front of you. I'm presenting a very brief summary overview of the governor's recommended budget, and the agency will be following me right afterwards with more details. On page 2, there are two pie charts showing the natural resources policy area by all funds and by general fund lottery funds. And there are 14 agencies. DEQ portion makes up 20% of the total funds and 11% of the general fund lottery funds. And then the next four pages are different views of the governor's recommended budget for DEQ. On page 3, you'll see that by fund type, other funds is the largest category of funding. And this, the revenues for this come mainly from regulation and permit fees, loan proceeds, et cetera, charges for services. Loan proceeds is actually for other funds, non-limited, which is the second largest. And that is the Clean Water State Revolving Fund mainly. And when the agency presents its material, it will be presenting based on operating versus non-operating and be focusing mainly on the operating portion of their budget. This Clean Water State Revolving Fund, Other Funds Non-Limited, is really the non-operating portion that you'll be seeing in their presentation. On page 4, there's another view of the budget, which shows the different program units. Again, in this particular view, the non-limited, essentially the Clean Water State Revolving Fund, is the largest program unit. On page 5, there's a view by expenditure category. Personal services is the largest category, followed by special payments, and again, big chunk of the special payments is for the Clean Water State Revolving Fund revolving loan. And then services and supplies is the third largest category. And in this particular agency, there's quite a bit of funding for contracts for cleanup of contaminated sites. On page 6, there is the information about historical actual expenditures and the governor's recommended budget for 2005-07. Major changes over time include reduction, basically elimination of companion loans for the 2003-05 budget. And then there's also no new orphan site bonds for 2003-05 and 2005-07. And that's the other funds, non-limited. There's also been some fund shifts currently in 2003-05 and also proposed for 2005-07. Using both Measure 66 lottery funds and Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery federal funds. There's a series of puts and takes throughout natural resource agencies, and this is one of the agencies that we're recommending this be done for. Then there were also some reductions through the special sessions that were permanent, and these included eliminating a cross-program and green permits coordinator. There was a reduction of 3 positions in the air quality permitting program. There was also a reduction to non-fixed services and supplies. And there was financing or a different way of financing debt service in 2003-05 using interest earnings on some of the loan program. The change from the legislatively approved budget for 2003-05 to 2005-07 basically results from personal services and services and supplies increases. And for personal services, essentially it's the PERS rate. And again, you'll see your LFO analyst recommending changes to that PERS rate based on action that was taken in February 2005 by the PERS board. We used a higher rate last fall. We were told that it was going to be higher, but that action in February means it will be nearly a percentage point lower. And also flexible benefits as part of the compensation package help explain some of the increase from 2003-05 to 2005-07. On page 7, there are some major policy issues, which I've categorized by protecting human health and the environment, delivering excellence in performance and product, and stable and adequate funding. I'll move on from there to page 8 to take a look at the investments in the governor's recommended budget that addresses these major policy issues. The first one there is some resources for the wastewater permitting backlog that would change the way that some positions are funded and continue those positions that would otherwise go away, and then also adds positions gradually to take care of the backlog. There is funding for the Willamette River Clean Water Plan, and the agency will be describing each of these in more detail in a moment. We continue program resources for drinking water protection, homeland security, chemical terrorism response, underground storage tanks. There's a federal data sharing project and the vehicle inspection program. There are additional resources for laboratory rent for the new laboratory space. There are also resources for coastal beach bacterial monitoring and also resources for a new clean water state revolving loan fund activity. On page 9, there are also some reductions, and there are really two categories of reductions in this budget. The first one, the first bullet that you see there, is sort of a naturally occurring reduction. It wasn't something that was necessarily forced because of statewide budget problems. This has to do with, one, there were some efficiency results, especially in the air quality program, which has meant that they don't necessarily need the same number of employees that they've had in the past. And then there are some issues with revenues, and we require that for a balanced budget that expenditures be reduced down to meet the revenue level, and those both have affected air quality and land quality. Then the remainder of those bullets, the air quality program, the water quality program, the land quality program, and the pollution control fund debt service are all actions that were taken from a list that the agency prepared along with every other agency in its agency request budget, indicating where it would recommend the first cuts, if necessary, be taken from. And so the agency has, in fact, already been reduced in the governor's recommended budget to meet statewide budget problems. As I mentioned before, there's a fund shift of the general fund to Measure 66 lottery funds that's recommended as well for 2005-07. Moving on to page 10, fee and revenue issues. There are two Senate bills. The first one is Senate Bill 44. This is for the land quality program, underground storage tank program, and this would allow the agency to continue to operate the program with the level of staffing that it currently has in 2003-05. If this bill didn't pass, then there's a sunset that would eliminate the ability to collect fees in the second half of the biennium, and that would affect the ability of the agency to keep those staff working. And then Senate Bill 45 is the wastewater permitting bill, and that would implement the recommendations from what the has been called the Blue Ribbon Advisory Committee. And the agency will be discussing that in much more detail, so I'll just move on. And finally, there's a technical adjustment for the vehicle inspection program in the air quality program. And this would essentially bring carryover limitation into 2005-07. There was a project to bring the analyzers and some of the information technology equipment that's outdated and no longer supported up to date in 2003-05. But because of a delay in the request for proposal process, that is not going to happen before the end of this current biennium. We didn't realize that last fall when the governor's recommended budget was put together. So we are recommending that the subcommittee consider bringing that limitation onto the 2005-07 budget. And that's about $1.6 million total. Other funds that would come from the ending balance. And then the agency will be describing the components of that in a moment. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them.
Questions or comments from Ms. Pearson? Thank you so much. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, this is the packet that we handed out. It is the agency presentation that starts with a slide that says 2005 budget and legislative goals. is appearing on the wall magically. And I covered these in phase one briefly. Our budget and legislative goals are to enhance services that support communities and make it easier for businesses to locate and thrive in Oregon and to provide a positive business climate for Oregon. Example was just referred to of our Blue Ribbon Committee and the work we've done on Senate Bill 45 and the wastewater permitting package. The second goal is to maintain environmental accomplishments we've achieved to date. And this supports the governor's principle to attract jobs and prosperity to Oregon because of our livable environment. And an example of that will be our water quality policy package for continuing to clean up the Willamette River. And our third goal is to retain delegation of federal regulations so that the state, not the federal government, is accountable to Oregonians for environmental protection in Oregon. And an example of that is Senate Bill 44 and our hope to continue the underground storage tank program and obtain federal delegation for that program. The next slide shows the total governor's recommended budget for DEQ, which is $263.5 million and 778 FTE. Lisa's covered most of this. What I would just point out is that almost 7% of our total budget is debt service, which is shown by the dark blue slice at the bottom right of the pie. Just above the debt service pie slice, you see the revolving loan fund, 27% of the total budget for that. And then everything in the large slice represents about 66% of our total budget. This $172.4 million is what we referred to as our operating budget. This funds our day-to-day program work, and it is going to be the focus of the rest of my remarks on our budget. This pie chart shows that $172 million operating budget by fund type. The day-to-day work is funded by 11% general fund, 66% fees or other fund, 21% federal funds, and 2% lottery. And all of those lottery dollars are in the water program for Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds work. In general, the fees and the federal funds pay for federally delegated regulatory work. The general funds pay for much of DEQ's technical assistance and for base regulatory work in the air and water programs. The general fund support that goes to technical assistance helps businesses that don't have staff or expertise in environmental regulations. Many of these businesses do not pay fees, or they pay smaller fees that don't cover the cost of technical assistance. This next slide shows the $172 million operating budget as it is allocated to each of our three major program areas, that's air, water, and land, and to agency management. Each of the three major program areas has a distinct operating budget. Agency management also has a distinct budget and includes the Office of the Director and the Management Services Division. Cross-media is a budgeting structure. It is not an organizational program. It was created to better manage funds and activities that support more than one DEQ program. And I'll explain that to you in more detail when we get there. If you don't have any questions on the general numbers, I'm going to move right into each specific program.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For air quality, I'd again invite Andy Ginsberg to join me at the table in case you have any detailed questions. As we covered in phase one, the purpose of our air quality program is to provide healthy and clean air for all Oregonians. We monitor the quality of Oregon's air. Where air quality doesn't meet federal health standards, we work with communities to develop clean air plans. You heard me refer to those maintenance plans earlier. We issue and enforce permits for about 1,200 regulated facilities. We reduce air pollution from vehicles through the Vehicle Inspection Program, the Clean Diesel Program, and Clean Air Action Days. We use regulation, technical assistance, and incentives to reduce air pollution from smaller area sources such as open burning, wood stoves, gasoline fueling, painting and asbestos removal, and to reduce air toxics. And finally, we work with communities to reduce air pollution at the local level and through voluntary measures.
This slide shows the governor's recommended air quality operating budget of $44.2 million by fund type. There are 249 FTE in the air program, and about 141 of those are in the vehicle inspection program. Over three-quarters of air quality activities are funded by fees, which are shown as other funds on this chart, and there's one piece of the pie for the vehicle inspection program and one for the permitting regulatory program funded by fees. During phase one, I reviewed the success of Oregon's clean air work, and we just talked about that again a minute ago. While we are currently meeting federal clean air standards, I am concerned about the future of Oregon's air because we face significant challenges due to the budget cuts and reductions that you've heard about already, and also some permit potential shortfalls in fees that we will be looking at in the coming biennium, and I'll talk more about that later. The governor's recommended budget, as you heard, cuts $1.1 million in general funds for clean air work and also reflects a $500,000 reduction in federal funds for air quality monitoring and a $1.2 million shortfall in the permit fee revenues. And the net result of all of that is in 05-07, we will have 13 less staff doing clean air work. And as was discussed earlier, those reductions the total of all those reductions are what was taken in the GRB, does include some efficiencies, as we mentioned, and also positions that we simply had to cut because we've either had reductions in federal grants or we've had not sufficient fee revenue in the air quality permit fees as they stand. And we chose not to ask for fee increases in air quality this session because we're focusing on water, but we will be working during the interim with an advisory committee, and we will be back next session to talk about increases in our federal and state air permitting program.
Can you talk to us a little bit about why there is a fee shortfall?
I will ask, I probably can, but not as well as Andy, so I will ask him to talk to you a little bit about both the air contaminant discharge permit fees, which are the state permits, and the Title V, which are the federal.
Madam Chair, again, for the record, Andy Ginsberg, Air Quality Division Administrator. We have two different permitting programs for industrial facilities. The air contaminant discharge permit program is funded primarily by fees. It also has some general and federal funds in it, although over the years the portion of fees has increased. The last time we increased the air contaminant discharge permit fee was in 2001, and so just from roll-up costs, we haven't we've had higher expenses for the current level of staff, but we haven't had any fee increases. We've been able to absorb that so far, as Director Halleck mentioned, through efficiencies. We had a major efficiency effort in that program, and we're able to absorb a 4 FTE reduction in that program without reducing service to the regulated community. So we're pretty proud of that accomplishment, but we won't be able to continue that into the next biennium. We're eating into our ending balance below the level needed just for current operations, and by next biennium we'll have a big problem there. On the Title V permitting program, which is the federally directed program for the largest industrial facilities, that program is 100% funded by fees as mandated by the Clean Air Act, and that fee is set based on the emission levels, not based on the amount of work that it takes to issue the permits. The fee does have an automatic inflation adjustment for the Consumer Price Index, so it has increased over the years by the Consumer Price Index. That has not kept up with the increased cost just for our existing staff level. And so when you combine the fact that the cost of personnel has increased faster than the Consumer Price Index and the fact that emissions have gone down, so the amount of revenue for the emission fee is lower, we're now at the point where we're having to reduce staff in the Title V program, and that problem is expected next biennium to become much, much larger.
Representative Krieger.
People comply, pollution goes down, and you get less fees.
And the cost goes up.
If that continues, you're never going to get done. You lose forever. Efficiency means less money.
And the permit holders get penalized for the efficiency. So how do you get out of that box?
Madam Chair, the permit holders who are actually able to reduce their emissions do get the benefit of lower fees, but it does generate less revenue for the program. And because the program is required to be funded 100% by fees, overall, we either have to reduce staff or we have to raise the fee level. We will
or become more efficient, as we have also done.
As we have done. And we will be talking with the fee payers in the interim, as Director Halleck mentioned, both about additional efficiencies we can do, the level of service that they want, which would translate into the level of staffing that we need to have, and how they want to pay the fee. Right now, the majority of it is paid through the submission fee. A small portion of it is also paid on a flat fee per facility, and they may choose to shift more of it to that type of funding so we can stabilize the funding situation.
So these are discussions that you expect to have with the fee payers in the interim?
Yes.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. We never come to this body with a fee proposal of any kind that we have not worked thoroughly through with the people who pay the fees.
I can imagine that there is a certain amount of consternation on the part of the permittees that they're in this kind of spiral into higher fees.
Madam Chair, if I may respond to that, I think that, and they obviously could respond to your question and should better than I, but we, as you've seen from dealing with our budget, we are increasingly, every biennium, more dependent on fees for funding. And so I have to say that our stakeholders and our fee payers are, shall we say, accustomed to having conversations with us about fees. They are ongoing all the time in one program or another every biennium. Part of the problem Andy alluded to is true in all of our programs, which is that we do not have roll-ups. And I think in previous biennia, we've discussed this quite a bit with you. And so we are always running behind to at some level. If you put it off, as we have done with AIR now for a couple of biennia, it gets worse. It just cumulatively gets worse. So then by the time you're coming in and asking for a fee increase, it's generally higher than it would have been if you did a little bit every biennia, which is a policy choice that you make, you just have to make sometimes. And we do need to be as efficient as we can be. And as Andy mentioned, we have absorbed some losses of FTE on both the federal side and on the state side. I would not feel comfortable going into the next biennium saying that we could continue to do that and deliver the program that the fee payers want us to deliver. And part of the problem on the Title V side is the federal mandate is that the program will be funded by fees. And the fee is in statute, and so that brings a whole other discussion.
So talk to us about who are the permittees here.
In air quality, one thing that is primarily different than in water quality, on the water side you have a lot of municipal fee payers. In the air side, there may be a few but not many. It's mostly industrial, pulp and paper. Associated Oregon Industries has a number of clients of different kinds of industries, steel mills, et cetera. It's basically your standard industry sources that have air emissions.
Senator Bates.
Madam Chair, thank you. You seem to mention there the way of stabilizing this by charging a flat fee per industry or per site. How about giving some more information about that? What does that look like? What does it cost the stakeholder? And are the people you're regulating wanting you to go to that so you can stabilize this?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, we're still in the process of developing those kind of numbers, so I can't give you detail. But something like 90% of our revenue comes from the emission fee now, and about 10% of it comes from the flat fee per permittee or from modification fees. And so it would be possible to change that ratio. That choice about how to fund the program was made by the permittees when we initially started the program back in 1994. And so we could revisit that. The problem with it is there will be winners and losers. Those with the highest emissions will get the biggest benefit from a shift like that, and those with the lowest emissions will pay more. And so it may not be a simple discussion to have with the fee payers.
Well, what does one of those permittees end up paying as 90% of it's site-based? give me a picture of what that actually looks like financially for these. Is it based on their pollution, or is it based on their size of their company and what they produce? I mean, I can see it could be very difficult for a small outfit, but maybe not so difficult for a large corporation. Well, what's give me a feel for it.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, the emission fee is currently in the order of about $30 per ton of emissions. So depending on the size of a facility, the fee can range from anywhere from a few thousand dollars per year to, for our largest fee payer, in the order of $60,000 per year. That would be for the Portland General Electric coal-fired power plant. And the flat fee per facility is more in the order of about $4,000 per facility now. So you could, for example, have a tiered system where it's a flat fee, but smaller businesses pay a smaller flat fee. There's many possible ways, you know, of structuring the fee table. Our first step is really to talk with the industry about what level of service they require or desire in terms of permit turnaround and support, technical assistance, and so forth, and figure out from that what the fee, total fee level needs to be, and then we can present them with a number of scenarios for how that fee would look. We haven't had any of those discussions yet with the fee payers.
How do you make sure when you're having those discussions that you're involving a broad spectrum of stakeholders?
Madam Chair, we have advisory committees for every, first of all, every fee that we do in the department, if it's not in statute, it has to be adopted by rule by the Environmental Quality Commission. So that in and of itself requires a public process. Beyond that, we always convene advisory committees. You've heard reference to the Blue Ribbon Advisory Committee on Water. Those are multiple stakeholder. In the case of water, we had municipalities, we had environmental groups, we had various industries. So we include anybody who might have a dog in the fight, so to speak. And we will do that with the air fee payers as well. Sometimes there'll be subcommittees of those advisory committees if they're looking at specific technical issues or whatever. So both the advisory committee process and the regular Environmental Quality Commission public process generally invite everybody in.
But you invite representatives of professional associations, or do you notify all the permittees that this is a discussion? Do they want to come to it? How does that work?
Madam Chair, all of the above. We will sometimes when you send an invitation, often we will contact professional association representatives and ask them to send someone, or would somebody please participate, and they will often ask someone who is a member and is a facility representative. The one thing I have to say is it takes some time to participate on these advisory committees, and so the folks who do, you know, we really appreciate it and value it, but not everybody can do it. So we generally have a mix of specific facility representatives and some professional association people. It's all over the board, really. What I will do now, we talked earlier about the concern about the priority list and the pollution coming from the area and mobile sources. So what I'd like to move on to talk about now is right into the policy packages, if you have any further discussion about the priority list.
Senator Bates.
I'd just like to make a comment for the record here. Correct me again if I'm wrong. These are new budgets for me. You know, many of our agencies outside of natural resources and others are having a struggle to meet their goals and get where they want to go. If I'm reading my records correctly here, my area, Medford Ashland, is going to be taken off the in places in Taman area. We've cleaned up our air over the last 6, 7, 8 years to the point that we're no longer being listed. I think Portland's already there, and other areas of the state that we're not on that list are going to be probably moved off in the next year or two. It appears this is an agency that's done its job. It's gotten our air clean with the cooperation of industry and others in our areas. And we're now looking at cutting your budgets because you've done your job. And frankly, if the job has been done, you can maintain with less. That's appropriate. I think I come into this with a suspicion of agencies that probably isn't founded in your case. And I think you've done an excellent job from what I can see here of getting where you want to go to. Am I missing the big picture here?
Well, first of all, I would thank you for those remarks. And then secondly, I would say it's not quite as simple as having a list that you're either on or off. You're absolutely correct in saying that we are in attainment with ambient air quality standards throughout the state. But we have a number of communities, and that would include Southern Oregon, that are on what are referred to as maintenance plans to be sure that you stay there. So we've made it, but we have to be constantly vigilant is what that really means.
Agreed. And I understand that comment, and I agree that you have to make sure we stay there, and we'll monitor it to make sure it happens. But on the overall picture is we've made progress and gotten to our goals.
We have, sir. And the other thing I would add is just as in water, we always have new challenges, and now both on the water side and the air side, we're looking at toxics. And the work that we have done in air up till now has been carbon monoxide, has been particulate, have been other pollutants. We have new ones that we are concerned about now.
And the new ones that you're concerned, I mean, one of the things that I've run over or run into during the years that I've been involved in this is that federal standards change. And so suddenly you think you've hit, you know, you're getting close to the goalpost and the goalpost moves.
And Madam Chair, I don't mind those goalposts moving. Is there good reasons for moving them? I mean, when I first moved to Medford, we had wigwam burners, and we burned tires at this time of the year to keep the orchards from freezing, and we just don't do that anymore. The difference is dramatic.
That's correct, Senator Bates. And the other, of course, major issue that is being debated is carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases and climate change and what all is going to happen about that, and will it in fact require more regulation that isn't required right now, and that debate is happening nationally.
I would defer to the national level there. That is a bigger picture than Oregon, and that's still an open question as far as the science is concerned.
Are there standards in air quality that we enforce in the state of Oregon that are exceeding the national requirements?
I'll let Andy answer that question.
Madam Chair, no, our standards are equal to the federal requirements. EPA is looking at the particulate standard now, though, and it's fairly likely that, as you alluded to, where the goalposts would change, that EPA is going to tighten the particulate standard. And I would point out to Senator Bates that could particularly affect areas like Medford, where we could once again be looking at non-attainment with the new fine particulate standard.
Moving the particulate size down another notch so that...
Another micron.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Moving on into the air quality policy packages. Now, as we move through this, we're going to need to work with the big budget binder, the big black book. And the first package that I'm going to discuss is on page 327. And I will, the page references should be on the slide, and I will also give them to you as I go to each package. Okay.
This is a big part of our exercise program.
Big part of the timber industry, too.
I'm going to talk first about Air Quality's Essential Package 090, and you will see in each of the programs there is an essential package with this number. This package reflects the governor's recommended budget proposal to reduce the air quality program by $1.1 million, which is a 23% cut to Air Quality General Fund. We talked a little bit about this already, but this cut briefly will reduce our work with small businesses and area sources to lower toxic air emissions. It will eliminate 3 air quality monitoring sites. It will reduce air quality monitoring at 11 at the 11 remaining sites. We will delay our clean air planning for Salem. We will delay some work on the Columbia Gorge visibility project. We will reduce the administrative support we are providing to our technical staff.
And we will reduce technical support and analysis for air toxics monitoring data. And finally, we would reduce the general fund support for the Lane Regional Air Pollution Authority by 24%. And let me just say, for those of you who don't know, the AIR program allows for local delegation of the work if you want to do that. And we have one area of the state that actually runs the AIR program for us, and that is the Lane County area through the Lane Regional Air Pollution Authority. They actually have authority in that county, and we provide funding for that.
The portion of general fund support that goes to the Lane Regional Air Pollution Authority, when you take this 24% of the general fund out, what percentage of the budget, of the total budget, does this represent?
For LRAPA?
Their budget
was $118,790, or is that just our share of it?
That was just our share.
Okay, why don't you give them the numbers then?
Madam Chair, for fiscal year 2003 to 2004, the Lane Regional Air Pollution Authority's budget was $2.7 million, so a fairly small portion of it comes from the general fund, although it's a very important portion for them. They also receive permit fees. They receive dues from the county and the city. They have the same Title V fees that we do, and they get a federal grant just like we do. But the general fund is an important piece of their budget as well.
Are there other parts of the DEQ funds, federal funds, or anything else that goes into combined with this general fund support?
Madam Chair, LRAPA gets 10% of the federal grant that comes into Oregon. It goes directly from EPA to LRAPA, but it is shared. Oregon's portion is shared between the two agencies.
Okay, if there are no further questions on this package, I'm going to move to the next package.
Let's go for it.
Okay. This is package 113 that pertains to the vehicle inspection program, and it's on page 337 of the big book.
I really want to take a minute to commend you for putting the page numbers on the slides. That is very cool.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will convey that to Patty Seastrom, who did all this work.
And the other agencies, please.
No, we'll go to that ERT meeting after.
I'm actually following this. It's kind of scary.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you know, the vehicle inspection program is fully fee-supported. It has no general fund, and we are not requesting a fee increase. The vehicle inspection program operates in the Portland metropolitan area and in Medford, and the program currently has 105 permanent and 50 limited-duration folks working in it. This package continues 36 limited duration FTE. We are in a process of phasing out the limited duration staff that are needed because of the improvements that we've made in technology. And by the end of 07-09, we do not anticipate needing any limited duration staff in the program.
Is the phasing in of technology that doesn't require people to be there, is that happening also in Medford?
Yes, it is, Madam Chair.
It just as an anecdotal story, last month I ran four cars through. When you have teenage kids, they just can't get it done, okay? And when you have no title, you know, you can get them registered, it just drives you crazy. It was pretty amazing. I've been going there for a couple of years, and when the two of the cars, just one person did it, and they put something in the hood, and they weren't checking the tailpipe or thing, is boom, we were through. It was fast, it was quick and efficient, and I was impressed. I wasn't there more than 10 minutes for any of the cars. And the guys were friendly. It's kind of like driving into Les Schwab where they're, you know, you meet you and you're really, really going, and it reminded me of that kind of service. I was impressed.
Thank you, Senator Bates.
Yeah. Muffler people. And I guess if they're not looking at your muffler, I have to call them something else.
Yeah. I was impressed. Did a great job. I was in and out of it. Boom, boom.
Thank you, Senator Bates.
And a few words of my kids can't get the job done by going over there, but that's a different story. If you can help with that, I want to move on.
Well, we are continuing to make improvements, and I think I might have mentioned some of this in Phase 1. We do offer DMV registration at our test centers, and together with DMV this fall, we hope to be able to begin accepting debit or credit cards for both our services and for DMV services. And we have a couple of stations where leases are going to expire in the metropolitan Portland area, and we hope to actually have a combined co-located DMV DEQ facility to replace those. So that was the easy part. Now I have, in your packet, you have a revised policy package for this that reflects the technical adjustments that Lisa referred to in her presentation. This is part of our continual desire to seek technological improvement in this program. And I will sit tight till I make sure everybody has it.
Madam Chair, I thought that was a continued desire to confuse us.
Oh, no.
We can handle this, Senator Bates.
Okay, there are two parts to this. The first adjustment is for a one-time increase in professional services expenditure limitation of $915,000 to replace failing vehicle test equipment and the support software. It's described on page 3 of the handout. The replacements have been anticipated, and as Lisa indicated, we have carryover limitation. We want to carry over limitation from the existing vehicle inspection fee. And as she also explained, the limitation wasn't included in our budget request because we expected to complete the work in the current biennium, but the project has been delayed. The upgrades are critical for ongoing operation at the test centers, and without them, we will have lane closures and long lines as the existing analyzers fail.
What's the reason for the delay?
Andy can speak in more detail, but my understanding is that the RFP process just took longer than DAS anticipated that it was going to take.
So this just carries forward into this biennium, a program that was supposed to be completed by now.
It's supposed to be actually happening in this biennium as we speak. We need to carry forward into 05-07.
Madam Chair, when will that program actually be completed then?
When will it actually be completed?
When will the new equipment be online and being used?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, we hope to complete it within, I believe it's about 6 to 9 month process. We have selected a contractor now. We are in the process of negotiating the final contract with them. And then it's a matter of installing new analyzers, putting in new software, and you know, the new server system, so it'll take a little while to actually complete it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, and just as a way of a little bit of background, the department appeared before the Joint Legislative Information and Technology Committee and discussed these technology issues they were going to have. They had limitation in for some of these costs in the current biennium, and so what this really is just carrying over something they had planned to expend this biennium into the next biennium.
Thank you, Mr. Siebert. The second adjustment is for an additional $718,000 in one-time professional services limitation to pilot self-service testing and online or mail-in testing. Self-service testing would allow customers to perform their own tests 24 hours per day in a self-service test facility. Online or mail-in testing would enable customers to send onboard emission information to DEQ over the internet or through the mail. And again, this money is just to pilot an approach, because this whole program, as you know, has been focused toward technological efficiencies, which is one of the reasons we've been able to reduce the resources in the program over time. This is sort of the next generation of innovation that we would like to test. And
talk to us a little
bit. Really, I'm really intrigued. This is going to affect me directly. I mean, I think he's going to get me, so please.
How about the mechanics of a program that would allow people to do this over the internet? How does that functionally happen?
Madam Chair, the last major technological innovation we had was to change from tailpipe emission testing to testing the car's onboard computer. Cars that were built in 1996 and newer have sensors that track the efficiency of the catalytic converter and all the other emission control equipment and actually store in the computer a code when that equipment is failing or has failed. And that's why we can test cars so much more quickly now. We simply plug into the car's computer, download the information, and we get a printout that tells us exactly which component has failed and so forth. The next step for that would be to provide that data over the internet or through other more convenient forms. So essentially what would happen is that the same place where we would plug an analyzer into the car, which is under the dash, we would actually plug in a data logger, a little device that would capture the information from the car's computer. And then once every 2 years when a customer's car was due for testing, they would simply unplug the data logger, take it up to their home office, plug it into a USB cable, and submit the data to us over the internet. Then with the credit cards, we would be able to do the entire transaction over the internet and update the Department of Motor Vehicles records to show that this car had actually passed the test, all electronically. And then the individual could register their vehicle. As you know, DMV in this last year has started online registration, so we can couple the two and actually do the registration, the entire thing over the internet.
You're going to hear about this.
The kids might do this one.
They might, Senator Bay. I can guarantee you I'm 58. I will never do this. But your children might actually do this.
I think there would be certain people that would never be able to be convinced that the only information you were taking out of their computer had to do with their car.
Madam Chair, we've surveyed our customers about this technology, and we have something like 60%, 66% of those we surveyed said that they would be interested in trying the self-service testing, and 37% said they'd be interested in the online or mail-in testing. We expect in practice those numbers might be a little bit lower, but the self-service testing was very, very popular with the customers because it's 24 hours per day and they can, you know, it will be fairly similar to using an ATM machine in terms of how difficult it is.
Excuse me, Krieger.
I purchased a new microwave. I had it for about 14 months before I would ever use it. My grandchildren use it. All the young people know how to use it, but you got to push about a series of buttons. I used to have one just turn the time and push one button. It was that long before I could. And that might, you know, technically challenged. The mouse on the computer, they either trap it, shoot it, or poison it. what are you talking about? So some of us are never going to get there, and this scares me where we're going here.
Madam Chair, I would guess if you age those questions, you might have a cutoff at about age 45.
And Manager, just to be clear, these will be optional tests, and it will always be possible for anyone to come to one of our test centers. But we do expect that technologies like this will at a minimum, enable us to handle the increase in population and number of vehicles without adding staff, and we're hoping in the long run that enough people will be interested in this that we may be able to reduce staff further.
So what I'm visualizing is something like a jump drive that you'd plug into your car and then plug it into your computer?
Correct.
So what's the cost of it?
The actual device that gets plugged into the computer will cost initially $30. As part of the pilot, we're planning to purchase 5,000 of them and use them in the testing. We're hoping that with mass production, the cost will go down maybe to $25 or $20. That would be a one-time fee that a customer would have to pay, and that data logger could then be used in all of their future cars. We would just reprogram it so it would work when they trade their car in. Also, EPA is looking at similar technology nationally, so it may be that within a few years that type of thing is built into the car or available more widely.
Then you'll just have to take them out of your kids' car and put them in your computer.
Yeah. I see it coming.
And when are you planning to start this?
Madam Chair, if assuming that you approve the limitation for this, it would be this, the same contractor that's replacing our analyzers and our software would do this work, and so it would just be part of the same project over the next year or year and a half.
And how are, or what's the performance measure for this? How do you know if this is successful?
Madam Chair, the primary initial measure is going to be built. We're going to build one self-service test lane, and it will be built at one of our existing facilities. So we'll have a inspector available at least during our working hours to assist customers who want to use it with a little help. So the initial test, initial measure for us is just successfully completing the programming and the technology piece of it to show that it works. We'll also be tracking things like vandalism to make sure that we can have something like this open to the public 24 hours a day with video surveillance to, you know, to ensure that it's...
This is the self-service piece.
This will be the self-service piece, yeah. And for the other piece of it, similarly, it'll be technological questions to see whether we actually, through the pilot, can make it work. We're quite confident that we can, but that's the purpose of piloting it. And then if it does work, then it will be a question. The performance measure will probably be the percentage of customers using it. But initially, for the pilot, it's really going to be about demonstrating that the technology works.
But with the piece that you put onto the computer in the car, if you have a turnaround time of 2 years between the time the people get it and the time they actually have to report, it's going to take quite a while to figure out whether you've worked the bugs out of it.
Well, Madam Chair, during the pilot, we'll be checking much more frequently than that. We'll likely work with a fleet of vehicles, like a taxi cab fleet, and we will have an arrangement with them where we'll provide them the data loggers at no charge in exchange for them regularly checking the information for us, so we'll be able to demonstrate that it works.
Leaving me behind. My world. We're still in a rowboat.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, also, just for the record, the department was directed to report to the JLC IMT during the interim on progress of these two technologies. So the body will be kept abreast of the developments as they occur.
Okay. And again, the funds to pay for this come from the vehicle inspection program.
That's correct, Madam Chair. No general fund.
You just missed a really interesting one, Senator.
Between caucuses and constituents, I'm having a little issues.
Let's proceed.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move to the water program now and invite Holly Schroeder, the Water Quality Administrator, to join me. This should be page 13 of my agency presentation. And again, when we get to the packages, I'll call out the specific...
Thank you.
Specific... page in the budget book. As we covered in phase one, DEQ's water quality program protects Oregon's surface and groundwater. We develop water quality standards. We set total maximum daily pollutant loads, or TMDLs. We monitor water quality at 165 sites around the state. We issue and enforce permits for more than 4,000 industrial and municipal facilities. We regulate septic systems in partnership with the counties. We work with communities and other state agencies to help protect drinking water. We provide low-cost loans to upgrade municipal sewage treatment plants. And we control non-point sources of pollution with both regulation and incentives. This slide shows the governor's recommended water quality operating budget of $47.4 million by fund type. There are 201 FTE in the water program. The first thing you may notice is that funding for the water quality program is more balanced among fund types than you saw in air quality, which was heavily reliant on fees. Water quality is funded 29% from the general fund. These dollars provide support for a combination of base program activities, which include groundwater protection, setting standards,
statewide monitoring to provide data about long and short-term trends in water quality. 7% of the water quality operating budget comes from lottery dollars, which support the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. As you know, DEQ develops plans to restore clean water when rivers and streams do not meet water quality standards as part of the Oregon Plan. Other funds account for 34% of the water budget and are generally earmarked for regulatory programs such as the septic system program, wastewater permitting, certification of dredge and fill activities, and hydroelectric relicensing projects. Another 30% comes from EPA and supports implementation of federally delegated authorities under the Clean Water Act, which includes issuing federal water permits. As I mentioned in Phase 1, regulated sources have stated a clear preference for the state running these programs as opposed to the feds. As we discussed earlier when you prioritized the list last month, you kept most of our clean water programs near the top of the list, and we appreciate you having done that. These are critically important that we keep general fund in the water program, as you can see from this pie chart. As I mentioned earlier, however, the non-point source program did end up at the bottom of the list, and I do have some concern that we not lose the $7 million in federal funds that are really invested in projects on the land to help improve watersheds. I'll move to the policy packages. The first one is Water's Essential Package 090, which is on page 433 in your big budget book. And what this package reflects is in 2003, this is basically that Lisa referred to the sort of the back and forth between lottery funds and general funds for Oregon Plan. In 2003, the legislature approved a one-time fund shift of approximately $4.5 million of water quality work from general fund to the Oregon Plan lottery funds and the Federal Pacific Coast Salmon Recovery Fund. Our DEQ's 0507 agency budget request proposed to shift back the $4 million to general fund. This package, however, reflects the governor's recommended budget, which returns this work to lottery funds and federal salmon money, and but it also cuts $494,000 of general fund from the water program.
The $800,000 that is the PCSRF funding, where is that going exactly within the agency? What does it fund?
Holly Schroeder will answer that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Holly Schroeder, the administrator of the Water Quality Program. The federal Pacific Coast Salmon Recovery Funds are largely used in our monitoring program associated with the Oregon Plan.
Can you give me some examples of what you're doing with it?
Sure. Madam Chair, a lot of that monitoring is what we call biomonitoring, and if we want to go into a lot of detail, I'll ask either our laboratory administrator to come up, or we can save that for some of the later slides. But in essence, what we are looking at is on some of the smaller streams, looking at the effect on aquatic life, and looking at sort of the overall health of aquatic life, actually monitoring what's going on in terms of the species in order to more fully assess our ability to restore salmon under the Oregon Plan.
So these are ongoing monitoring on certain streams where you're taking a look at a range of aquatic species and gauging it against what stream flows and
Madam Chair, I think if we're going to talk about this in detail, I will bring our lab administrator up because the lab does the monitoring.
I appreciate that.
Sure. Mary? And I'm sorry Senator Bates isn't here because I wanted to introduce to him our PhD chemist because I think he thinks we have no scientists at DEQ because he talks to me and Lori and other people. So Mary is a real scientist.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Morgan and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Abrams. I'm the Laboratory Division Administrator for DEQ. Your question, Representative Morgan, has to do with a program that we have run since about 1997 with the Oregon Plan effort that was started under Governor Kitzhaber at that time. There was a monitoring program that was established, really based primarily out of the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board work that involves a number of agencies. Our part in that really included going in and assessing small streams in the primarily in the coastal coho area, coho salmon area, as well as in the Willamette Valley. Really, none of that work has extended to the east side of the crest of the Cascades up until this point in time. The work that they do is to go out, and there's two efforts that they have. They have what they call reference sites, which are basically trending sites. They're sites that we visit from 1 year to the next so that we can see the long-term water quality trends. And then they also do what they call a probabilistic sampling. And the best way to think about this is with TV surveys. So they call up, you know, 30,000 people across the United States and say, what are you watching right now? Well, then they get an answer, and they do a survey, and they say, well, so X percent of Americans watch whatever, McNeil Lehrer report. There you go. I don't watch much TV, sorry. And so
better as those polls where they call you up and ask you how you're going to vote.
Yes, exactly. The same sort of thing, you know. So using this, we're able to go through a region and say 30% of the streams have been affected and have lower water quality or have been improved, and that's the ultimate goal of this work, is to be able to track, as people are putting improvements into watersheds, what changes develop from those improvements. We've been very involved over the past year working with the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board and the other agencies involved with the Oregon Plan, evaluating the coastal coho work that was started, again, under Governor Kitzhaber as the very first part of the Oregon Plan. And we have been able to use the work that we did both with the trending sites and with the more survey-oriented sites to look at the effect of what's gone on in the last 10 years, well, almost 10 years. Unfortunately, a lot of these things take time, and so we hope to continue that work. We have had some reductions, and so it will probably be at a reduced rate. But that's basically what we do. The monitoring itself, as Holly Schroeder alluded, really goes in and looks at the species that are there as well as the water chemistry so that you get an integrated view of the watershed. So you're looking at what bugs are there that support the salmon, what fish are there, both the salmon and other species, what does the habitat look like, that sort of measurement. That's then coupled, of course, with the chemistry that we collect on a regular basis.
So you're plotting that data over time with an overlay for things like culvert replacements and root wads in the creek and shade growing and all those kinds of things that we're trying to do with grants in the watershed councils?
Chairman Morgan, that is exactly what the overall assessment is attempting to do. We have provided our information based on our monitoring. We are not the principal sort of integrator of all of the information from the various agencies, but we have certainly provided our information to be integrated with the information from the other agencies, and that does include work by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and Oregon Department of Forestry that might have to do with either stream bed improvements or culvert replacements. The Department of Transportation, I know, has had some targeted efforts in the coastal coho area to try and replace culverts and such. Okay.
Senator Nelson has a question.
Just says here you have a monitoring water quality of 165 sites. This is what we're talking about now.
Chairman Morgan, Senator Nelson, actually the 165 sites reference are sites that we maintain from year to year for trending, and they include the sites, they include 14 sites in the Oregon Plan work, which is the type of work that I just described, as well as about 152 sites that we just do chemistry, water chemistry on. Those other sites, 151 sites, are located all the way around the state. So they occur throughout the state, not just in the coastal and Willamette Valley area.
Follow up?
So how long have you been doing this, and what are the results, and have you tied, are these, any of these tied to our benchmarks, to our key performance measures?
Chairman Morgan and Senator Nelson, yes, these are, the 150 sites have been tied to our benchmarks since the Oregon Progress Board started pulling together that information. Some of these sites have been in place since the 1940s. Some of them are more recent. So we actually have a pretty good record. We're able to do 10-year trending evaluations every year. We just go back and do the last 10 years. And so you will see those in your Oregon benchmarks. I don't remember, unfortunately, which exactly ones they are, but they talk about the percent of streams of increasing water quality. We use the Oregon Water Quality Index to assess the water quality at those sites. And so there's one for increasing water quality status and one for decreasing. And we talked when we presented during phase one about the streams that are maintaining their water quality.
So if I might just interject into your line of questions, when you talk about water chemistry, you're testing for the presence of certain chemical substances or the absence of them?
Chairman Morgan, we test for a number of things when we look at water chemistry. We look at things that are very basic parameters like dissolved oxygen and pH. We look at things that might cause problems or likewise you will need because they're required, things like nutrients. So you need a certain level, but you don't want too much, so phosphorus and nitrogen. We tend to lump in that some physical, we call it water chemistry as a generic term, but we also include some physical data, things like biological oxygen demand and microbiology data such as bacteria as well.
And how was the decision made about what to include in those measurements? Is this some kind of a national protocol that you're conforming to, or?
Chairman Morgan, there is, in fact, just this year, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, came out with a list of what they considered important for monitoring programs, water quality monitoring programs. The particular group that we have and have used historically in our trending sites really reflects the concerns that were the water quality concerns of that era. And they continue to be important. Temperature, oxygen, pH, all those things that affect aquatic life as well as drinking water quality and watershed health. There is a major gap in this that is more that is becoming more evident in the discussions both nationally and in Oregon, and that's the toxics, the toxic pollutants that Director Halleck referred to earlier. Toxics are a whole large group of compounds that affect that negatively affect organisms, and they're expensive to analyze. They don't tend to stay in water. And so quite a while ago, we decided with budget reductions way before the time I was here that it was not worthwhile to pursue the very small amount of toxics information we were gathering, and instead to maintain these what we call conventional parameters, the chemistry and bacteria and physical parameters that we do.
So this is pretty relevant. I mean, if you have some data from 1940, it'd be interesting to me to see in whatever particular watershed that's on. Are we making any progress, or is it staying the same, or is it getting worse? I mean, where are we at with all this?
Chairman Morgan, Senator Nelson, we can actually provide you with that information. We do produce every year a water quality index report, which really reflects the last 10 years, but we can certainly go back and make a compilation over a longer period of time if you're interested in that. We did look at something like that earlier on when we were talking about the Willamette, and so that particular water body is more readily accessible, but we can do the analysis for any of the longer term sites that we have, and we'd be glad to do that, particularly if you have a watershed that you're particularly interested in.
Satisfactory. It seemed to me that we should really have been improving a huge amount because we were spending a lot of money on this thing. And to me, there's a performance measure of some sort. Is it? And that's our charge. Are we spending the money in the right place? You've got drought conditions. You've got things that are going on, climatic changes that over a period of 40, 50 years. That sometimes I wonder whether we humans actually make that much of a difference. And Mother Nature has a way to cleanse herself sometimes.
Chairman Morgan and Senator Nelson, this is actually a passion sort of like Andy's of mine, and I don't want to take up all of the time. I know the committee's interested in this, but if you want me to come in and speak to you more in detail, I can. I will tell you that we around the nation are known because of our long-term trending sites for being able to pull some of this information together. And it's a very valuable tool for measuring. Some of our earliest performance measures did revolve around some of these water quality and air quality monitoring information that we gather routinely from the lab. It's also, you know, something that doesn't necessarily always support some of the direct programs except to show the value that we get out of them. So it's, you know, it's not a direct fee program or any of that. So it's kind of tends to be lost sometimes in the mix, but it is very valuable when you start looking at performance measures. And we would be happy to come in. I would be happy to come in and talk to any of you who are interested in more detail.
Streams have done. I like to be able to compare some of the ones from 1940 to now. That's the year I was born. I've deteriorated more than some of the streams.
I don't think we better go there. But I think that does go to Senator Nelson's question, as you know, from an overall perspective, is the water quality increasing and the habitat for aquatic species improving over time?
Madam Chair, I think what we should do in the interest of time is bring more detailed information, but we do in fact have in the performance measures and benchmarks that you've reviewed, the water quality index data is reflected, and as Mary said, some streams have improved and some have gotten worse. So we have some basically stayed the same. So we have a little bit of mix. We are held accountable currently in our performance measures for this data, but it's aggregate, and so we can, as Mary said, give you as much or as little detail, and we'd be happy to do that.
And in the interest of time, we had better move ahead here. Thank you so much. That was very interesting.
All right, I'll move on then to policy package 120, which is on page 436 of the big binder. And this is the policy package that pertains to the wastewater permitting program. You've heard me talk about this a lot, and to Senate Bill 45. Again, it reflects our priority to make the water quality permit program both effective and efficient. In 2002, we had the highest backlog of expired permits for major sources in the country. We shifted resources from other activities to bring the backlog down in the short run. We spent 2 years with the Blue Ribbon Stakeholder Advisory Committee to develop long-term recommendations to improve the program. And Package 120 and companion bill, Senate Bill 45, include the improvements and the funding increases recommended by the Advisory Committee, which would be phased in over two biennia. For 0507, Policy Package 120 restores 4 existing FTE and adds 1.25 FTE. With this package and Senate Bill 45, we will continue to reduce the backlog of expired water quality permits, and we will implement other streamlining and accountability measures. I need to tell you that in 0709, we'll be asking for an additional 2.5 FTE that was agreed to by the advisory committee, which will be another fee increase and a potential general fund request. So they actually mapped out a long-term two-biennia plan through this effort. I believe Senate Bill 45 has been referred to Ways and Means as well.
So if we buy this package at the end of 0507, what is the state of the backlog going to be?
And Holly Schroeder will respond to that question.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, what the Blue Ribbon Committee laid out was some fundamental changes to how we operate the program. And right now what we are targeting is that we would have the federal wastewater permits have the backlog of that down under 10% by the end of 07. So I don't have an exact target for the end of the biennium for you, but by the end of 07, that's what we're targeting.
Madam Chair, one thing I would point out, and Holly can speak in more detail, the committee acknowledged in terms of the balancing of the performance desired and what they're willing to pay for, that getting to zero backlog
was probably not what they were willing to pay for. And so I think 10% is where they came down.
So what is 10% a reasonable expectation for an ongoing backlog level that's workable?
Madam Chair, that's correct. That is sort of a rolling 10% is sort of what we're anticipating as an ongoing backlog level, and that is something that has been a target nationally. Many states are also struggling with permit backlogs, and that's sort of been the national target, is to try to keep your permit backlog under 10%.
So if you can get the backlog down under 10% by the end of 07, why do you need phase two of this?
Excuse me, Representative Morgan, members of the committee, the overall plan put forward for the program is for the entirety of the wastewater permitting program, not just for the issuance of permits. The whole program also has a compliance component and a monitoring component to it, and so the positions that we phase in 07-09 are focused on some enforcement resources, some laboratory resources, and an additional position that will sort of help us stay current in terms of policy work and emerging issues that we're anticipating will be sort of the next generation of issues. We'll be able to anticipate those. And so those are the positions that phase in 07-09.
How long do these permits last?
The federal permits under the Clean Water Act, Madam Chair, are five-year permits mandated by the Clean Water Act.
But, Madam Chair, there is a move afoot to try and extend that to 10 years in Congress because, as Holly mentioned, all the states are struggling with not being able to keep up, and that's one approach to that problem.
So is there a high probability that that's going to happen?
I wouldn't speculate, Madam Chair.
Okay. And the what happens to the permit fees? Where are they now, and where do they end up, and who pays them?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the permittees are individual dischargers of wastewater. It is, as Director Halleck alluded to, we do have a fair number of municipal permittees. These are the municipal sewage treatment plants. In addition, it is your industrial facilities. The large majors are going to be your pulp and paper plants and metals industries types of operations. There's also, if you recall, we discussed in phase one that we have a pretty widespread use of what we call general permits, which are a streamlined permitting mechanism for a sort of category of activities. For example, the drinking water treatment plants have filter backwash from when they flush their filters and they discharge that. We have a general permit for that, and the plants would register onto those, and so we have a pretty widespread use of that, as well as some stormwater permitting, which is one of the newer areas of permitting for the program. So that's sort of the range of permits permittees that we're looking at. What the Blue Ribbon Committee recommended was a series of changes to the fee, in the fee, because one of the objectives they wanted to get to was to sort of stabilize the funding for the program, because they recognized that it hadn't been stable and had been underfunded. So what they've asked us to do, the fee structure right now is a combination of either a new permit fee or a renewal fee that would come on that five-year cycle, plus an annual fee. And what we are going to be looking at is streamlining the permit fee table, which is multiple pages long and pretty complex, and was one of the an issue of a lot of discussion at the Blue Ribbon Committee. And so what they want us to do is to simplify that fee table and then normalize the fees over the five-year period so that there's not the bump when you have a renewal, which would be a higher fee 1 year, and they thought that would assist in their budgeting processes for the cities and the industries, as well as give us a more predictable revenue stream that would stabilize the funding for the program. Then based on that, they made some recommendations, which are the first phase of which are in this policy package, to increase the fees to support the restoration of staff in the first year of the biennium and then to add the 1.25 FTE in the second year of the biennium. We're looking at a 7% fee increase in the first year and a 4% fee increase in the second year.
What's the second year?
4%.
And that's just across the all the categories.
Right. We have not worked out the details at this point, Madam Chair, of the because we're going to do those first two steps of sort of streamlining the table and annualizing it. So those are going to be the first two steps. We're just sort of teeing up the process that we will be using and be working with stakeholders on that, and then we would apply the increase to that. We'll do it all in one. If this is approved, we would do it all in one, probably in one rulemaking, but sort of procedurally or stepwise, we would go through those other steps first and work with stakeholders in working through that process.
In terms of the permittees, you've told us that there are municipal permittees and that there are industrial permittees primarily in metals and paper.
Those would be the major industries. Beyond that, I would say one of our biggest classes of permittees is a general permit for stormwater, which is the construction stormwater permits. We also have industrial stormwater. The number of those permittees, and they again register onto that general permit, which is the more streamlined permitting mechanism, those number in the thousands. In terms of individual permits, there's about 370 or so in the state. So when you're looking at the entire permit universe, the stormwater permitting is actually our largest area.
So if I'm a contractor and I build houses and I've got some kind of a subdivision going and I have to deal with stormwater issues, do I have to get a general permit?
If you, Madam Chair, if the developer is disturbing over an acre of land, then they would need to get that.
So how much would my permit increase under this proposal?
Well, those permits, Madam Chair, right now, they pay a when they were to sign on to a new fee, they pay a fee that's in the ballpark, I would say, of $650, and then an annual fee that's, I believe, for as long as they need to keep that permit in place. So if it's a large development that might span multiple years and they wanted to keep the permit in place, I think the annual fee is in the neighborhood of $350. And so what we would be looking at is depending on how we work out the normalization and how that math works out, so somewhere you're in the neighborhood somewhere of $400 or $500 when you smooth out the annual fee over a five-year period, and then we would apply the 7% increase on top of that the first year and the 4% on top of that in the second year. And again, all of those details are things that we plan to work out in the rulemaking with the fee payers, those sort of individual fee categories. We didn't work that out at the Blue Ribbon Committee. They didn't want to go into that level of detail at that committee. They recognized that a lot of that was negotiations with fee payers, and so they gave us the instruction to sort of simplify the table, annualize, normalize over the five-year period, and so that is sort of where we're at in the process, is that we would be teeing that up with stakeholders as we begin our rulemaking, assuming that this is approved by the legislature.
What happens if we decide not to buy this package and the backlog continues at the whatever level? And what's going to happen?
Madam Chair, members of the committees, I think that there's a few things that happen. Environmentally, it means that these permits are not updated on a regular basis, which means that they're not going to reflect either updates in water quality standards or reflect changes due to the total maximum daily load. The water quality plans that Director Halleck alluded to earlier would not get reflected, so they would be discharging at higher levels. And that is a concern environmentally. In addition, EPA has expressed concern about our program. We had a program review conducted by EPA Region 10 last year that found a lot of concerns that with the program and how Oregon was running the program. We have responded to them largely by describing what we've done with the Blue Ribbon Committee and described how we are implementing those changes and how we are moving those forwards, and those have largely satisfied many of their concerns in the program. But whether or not they would continue to express, I would expect that they would continue to express those types of concerns if we didn't proceed.
Does expressing concerns really matter?
Well, Madam Chair, I think, you know, that the difficulty for states, this is a national problem. Underfunding in the water program is a national problem. And as I mentioned earlier, in general, and in this state for sure, the regulated community would prefer to deal with us rather than deal with the feds. But the reality is, if it gets bad enough, you know, if we can't get permits out the door, if we can't do compliance, if we don't have good monitoring data, the feds can take the program back, or we can throw up our hands and say we're overwhelmed and give it back, in which case then the regulated community is really the ones that you would need to ask the question of. They would be dealing with the U.S. EPA to get their permits and have their regulatory work done. At some point also, you have to consider the third parties and whether or not some of our folks are vulnerable to third-party lawsuits if we're not doing our job. And that's we've been able to manage, because we've had stakeholder support, because we've had support from this body, we've been able to manage funding this program so that we doesn't get that bad. But as I've told you before, when I became the director, I had three things that I wanted to get done, and this was top of the list, was fixing this program. I've been at DEQ for 16 years, and we've had struggles with this program all through that time, and I just decided enough. You know, we needed to get stable funding. We need to get the backlogs down. We need to run a good program. OMB is coming down really hard on EPA right now. They're doing program reviews in wastewater programs throughout the nation, and ours was one of them. And there is risk. How much risk? I think the fee payers would be the ones to tell you how much they support our running the program, and so far they've supported it. Oh, I'm sorry, Office of Management and Budget.
Senator.
Following along the same lines, we're comparing the three budgets of air, water, and land. I'm working from page 4 and 5 of your handout. Mm-hmm. You see, there's a general fund of about $19 million. And then land is, you spend $57 million of all funds. Water quality, you spend $47 million. And air quality, you spend $44 million. Then you go to those individual budgets, and you're spending more money in general fund for the water control, about almost $14 million, and only $1 million for the land and $3 million for the air.
That's correct, Senator Nelson.
So, I mean, how do you, is this what you're talking about, is that you're trying to do this water thing, we have to use more general fund to do that, or how? Why is there such a big discrepancy in those?
Senator Nelson, part of it, most of it really, is historical. I mean, the water program has always historically had a strong general fund base. I think what you're seeing as part of our effort here with Senate Bill 45 and this policy package is to, in fact, increase the amount of fees. There is some general fund request because the Blue Ribbon Advisory Committee said that basically they would agree to a three-legged stool. They wanted legislation that had program improvements. They would agree to a fee increase if there was a general fund share. That was part of the whole package. The other programs have had more heavy fee support initially. The air program has. One can speculate why. I wasn't around in the early days of when general funds were allocated to the agency, but there is one key difference between air and water that I pointed out before, and that is that in water there are a lot of municipal governments that are regulated, and they are not regulated under the air program. The same different acts, different requirements. And I think that that has contributed to a certain extent to what happens with the fee schedules over time. And in the land quality program, one of the reasons that that's most
that those programs, when they started, were not generally funded programs. The cleanup program is based on cost recovery, and we'll talk about that when I get to it. The solid waste program, when we took it on, was funded by tip fees right on the solid waste disposed at landfills right from the get-go. The hazardous waste program was a big federally, pretty heavy federal funds. So it all sort of tracks back to the origins. The origins of DEQ were on the water side, and I think were generally funded from the very, very beginning. It was the first program that started the agency, really.
I mean, this is the charge I think I'm hearing from the co-chairs as well. If we get to this $12.393 billion figure with existing funds, everything's fine. If we don't, we're going to have to find places to cut. And so we have to go to general fund things. And, you know, from my view, if I have to choose between a child and water quality, I'm going to vote for the education portion of it. And so what would happen to your agency if we got to the point where we had to take $5 million out of your general fund out of that $13 million?
Well, I think in this program, Senator Nelson, then we go back and have a conversation with the people we regulate in this state about whether or not we're going to be able to continue to run the water program.
We might be done with that choice if we don't come over to the 12.393. The agreement, as I understand, is if we that's what we're spending. If we're short in the general fund, then we have to make it up someplace. Is that right?
But if we take money out of this agency, we aren't getting any closer to 12.393. We're just moving the deck chairs around. So getting to, if we're not able, if we come up short of 12.393, then we need to look for other sources of revenue that are outside of what we've been budgeting.
We're also going to have to cut programs. Maybe we just take $5 million away and not put it in education. I mean, that's another possibility.
Well, I would remind you that we have committed to spend no more or no less.
That's what I'm saying. If we don't come up to that point, we might not be able to shift the funds, but we do have to take it away from some of these agencies.
But taking it away from the agencies won't get you to 12.393.
Yes, I mean, if you just take the general fund away and so you're not spending it, I mean, that's...
But how does that get...
I mean, if you're shifting it, you're right. If you're shifting it over to education, it's just a shift. But, I mean, we might have to cut...
Total spending,
yeah. I mean, we're going to have to cut some programs in order to get the 12.393. I mean, I don't see how the House we're going to get that.
I'm not tracking.
You think we're going to have to raise money in order to get there?
If we're shy of money, then we have to find money outside of the general fund and the lottery funds and all of the other funds that currently go in to form the budgeted amount.
And why are we going through this exercise then? That's
preparation.
That's what I don't understand. I mean, we're going to have to balance the budget someplace, and we only have $12 billion. Where is that $393 million going to come from? If we go out for a tax increase, the taxpayers say no. We're going to have to find, I mean, if we can't find that money someplace, we're going to have to take it out of some general fund budget someplace, aren't we?
We're out of time, so okay. Let's talk about this afterwards. But okay. Are we posted for this tomorrow so I can go ahead and close this?
Yes.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 5026 and House Bill 5027. We will reconvene at 1 o'clock tomorrow and continue this discussion.
Senator, please, you are...